and slowly lower my hands when neither Bob the guard nor the policeman make a move toward me. I'm fine. Thank you. The Levinsons' friendship with my parents goes back almost 2 decades, and my parents have always said that Agnes and Isaac consider me to be the daughter they never had. Until this moment, I was convinced it was an exaggeration. I certainly never thought of them as anything more than a nice older couple who happened to be my parents' friends. Agnes's defense of me, though, is more like something family would do, and I find myself absurdly touched. Especially when Isaac comes forward and starts haranguing my would-be arresters with all the legalese at his disposal, giving my dad a chance to grab my arm and pull me aside.
Quickly, darling, talk to me.
Dad's voice is low and urgent as his gaze roams over my face before lingering worriedly on the half-healed scar on my forehead.
What happened? What did he do to you? How did you get away?
Before I can answer, he leans in and whispers in my ear.
We need to get you to a lawyer right away. I know you had to say those things on the phone, but they refused to believe me. I overheard them talking about it, and they're going to invoke the Homeland Security Act on account of his links to terrorism. We need to get you a good attorney, or...
Sarah! Holy shit, girl! Where have you been? Marcia joins us, grabbing my arm like I'm about to evaporate into thin air. Her Marilyn Monroe curls sway wildly as she spins me to face her. What happened to you? Where did you go? Her blue gaze hones in on my scar, and she gasps. What happened to your face? Overwhelmed, I take a step back. Marcia, please.
Sarah Kobakis?
The baby-faced cop somehow got past the Levinsons and is shoving Marcia aside, his hand once again on the hilt of his weapon.
You need to come with me right now.
I raise my hands again. No problem. Please, I'm cooperating, I promise. Now it's my dad who belligerently steps forward.
She's not going anywhere until she gets a lawyer, and... Everybody freeze!
And as we all gape in shock, SWAT commandos swarm in the room, face shields lowered and weapons drawn. Chapter 11. Sarah. I told you, I don't know where he is, I repeat for the fourth time. I don't know how he got in and out of the country undetected, and I don't know the man who drove me from the airport. I've never seen him before. I'm sorry, but I really can't help you. Agent Ryson stares at me, his eyes cold in his weathered face.
You might want to rethink that, Dr. Kobakis. You're facing some very serious charges, and the less you cooperate, the worse it will go for you.
I'm cooperating fully. My nails cut into my palms under the table, but I maintain a calm tone. I've told you everything I know. I was kidnapped and taken to a remote mountain in Japan, where I stayed for the past 5 months, except for a brief sojourn to Cyprus, where my failed escape attempt resulted in a 2-week stay at a clinic in Switzerland. Ryson leans in, and I catch a whiff of stale coffee breath. He must have had to chug quite a bit to stay alert at this late hour.
How idiotic do you think we are, Dr. Kobakis? Nobody's buying into your act again. One of Sokolov's shell corporations owns your house, and has for months. We have eyewitness reports of your meetings with him at Starbucks, and in a club downtown, several weeks before your so-called abduction. Not to mention the recordings of all your phone calls to your parents.
I already explained all of that. I'm holding on to my calm by a thread. What I told my parents on the phone was an attempt to allay their worry about me. Nothing more. As to my meetings with him, yes, they happened. After breaking into my house, when he drugged and waterboarded me, remember? He disappeared for a few months, and then he returned and began stalking me. I reached out to you at that point and told you I felt like I was being watched. I asked you if he could possibly be back, and you assured me I was safe. But I wasn't. He was there, watching my every move, and you had no clue. You failed to protect me from him, just like you failed to protect George. So don't pretend like I had no basis to think that turning to you might be worse than useless. The agent's mouth thins as he leans back.
So you, what, decided to handle this psychopath on your own when he did show up? Do you really expect us to believe that?
My face burns at the derision in his voice. In hindsight, it wasn't the best decision, but at the time, I didn't see a lot of options. He said he'd come after me no matter where you hit me, implying that more people could get hurt that way, and I believed him. I didn't know what to do, so I went along with what he wanted, taking it one day at a time until I could figure out a better solution.
Oh, really? And what was it that he wanted?
I meet Ryzen's accusing stare with one of my own.
What do you think?
He's the first to blink and look away. Sighing heavily, he rubs his forehead in a weary gesture, and for a moment, I almost feel bad for him. If he accepts that I'm innocent, he'll also have to accept that he failed at his job, that he allowed a monster to invade my life and snatch me away right under their noses. It would be so much easier if I were the villain in this story, if they could somehow prove that I plotted against them all along. Except the facts don't really support it, and they know it. I've been here for over an hour, and for all their threats and posturing, they still haven't charged me. A knock on the door is followed by a female agent, poking her blonde head in.
Agent Ryzen, we need you for a sec.
He follows her out, leaving me alone in the small interrogation room, and I slump in my uncomfortable metal chair, exhausted. Then I recall that I'm likely being watched and sit up straight, trying to avoid looking at my pinched, pale face in the big mirror on the wall. I'm so stressed I'm on the verge of breaking, but I don't want them to know that. The interrogation, combined with the inevitable effects of jet lag and my worry about Mom, has taken everything out of me. And if I could, I'd collapse and sleep for the next 18 hours. Unfortunately, I have to stay sharp and alert. I have to convince them of my innocence, so I can be there for my parents. After the SWAT team stormed the hospital and dragged me out, I decided my best bet is to answer the agent's questions as truthfully as I can, omitting only what I'm certain I can get away with. Peter didn't give me any instructions in this regard, so he must expect me to reveal everything, and is already taking steps to mitigate the fallout, moving the team to a different safe house, and so on. As for the Kents, I'm pretty sure they're untouchable with all their wealth and connections, but I'm still playing it safe by not mentioning their names. There was no reason for the feds to assume such details would be shared with me, a prisoner. The main thing I intend to conceal, though, is the current state of my relationship with Peter, and that he'll come back for me soon. Any news about my mom? I ask Agent Ryzen when he returns to the room a few minutes later, and he nods, taking a seat across from me again.
The surgery went well, he says,
and a giant knot of tension unravels between my shoulder blades.
They found the source of the hemorrhage and fixed it, he continues. It's still too soon to pronounce her stable, but it's looking more encouraging.
Despite my determination to remain stoic, I have to blink rapidly to contain an influx of tears.
Thank you.
My voice is thick with barely contained emotion.
I appreciate this.
He shifts uncomfortably in his chair.
Of course, he says gruffly. We're not monsters here, you know. Which brings us to my next question, Dr. Kobakis.
He folds his arms across his chest and fixes a hard stare on me again.
If what you're saying is true, if Sokolov stalked, threatened, and kidnapped you, if he kept you captive all these months, why would he bring you back now?
I push all thoughts of Mom aside and focus on getting through this interrogation. The sooner I answer Ryzen's questions, the sooner I can see her. Sokolov got bored with me, I say without blinking, having mentally practiced the lie on the drive over. He tried to get me to warm up to him, allowing phone calls with my family and treating me fairly well in general. But I kept rebuffing his advances, and he finally got fed up. I suspect he might have found another unfortunate woman to fixate on, but that's purely speculation on my part.
Right.
The agent's tone drips with sarcasm.
He got bored with you, just when your parents needed you most.
No, he'd already begun cooling on me when this. I touched the scar on my forehead. Happened. Afterward, he couldn't even bring himself to touch me. Still, he kept me around until Mom's accident gave him an excuse to get rid of me. Ryson's bushy eyebrows lift mockingly.
He needed an excuse?
Don't all monsters fancy themselves angels? I keep my gaze steady on his face. Even the worst criminals like to think they're good people and just happen to be misunderstood. You of all people should know that. And Sokolov is no different, I can assure you. He convinced himself that he cared about me, and when he got bored with his new toy, he needed an excuse to throw it out. Mom's accident provided it, and here I am, only a little worse for the wear. I touch the scar again, as if bitter about the disfigurement.
Uh-huh.
Ryson stares at me without saying anything else, and I realize he's waiting for me to say something, to fill the increasingly uncomfortable silence. When I just keep looking at him calmly, he rises to his feet and gives me a stiff smile.
All right, Dr. Kabakis. My colleague informed me earlier that the lawyer your family engaged is already here, barking at our door. Since we have not yet formally charged you, you are free to go. For now. We'll be checking out your story, and if it turns out you lied, and I do mean about anything, no fancy lawyer will save you.
I understand. I hide my relief as I follow him out of the room. As I hoped, my cooperation gambit paid off. On the way here, I considered lawyering up, but I decided it would be best to act like someone who has nothing to hide, even at the risk of accidentally incriminating myself by answering questions without a lawyer. This strategy might still come back to bite me, but for now, I'm free to do what I came here for, spend time with my parents. A tall, sandy-haired man meets us once we exit the interrogation area hallway. To my shock, I recognize him. It's Joe Levinson, Agnes and Isaac's son, and apparently my attorney. Keeping a poker face, I shake Joe's hand and thank him for coming. He smiles politely at Ryson, promises that I will not leave town without notifying them, and calmly leads me to the elevator. It's not until we walk out of the building together and get into a cab that I let my astonishment show. I thought you practiced corporate law, I say, staring at the man who is, if not exactly a childhood friend, at least a very close acquaintance. How did you...
I was having drinks with clients downtown when my father called me,
Joe explains, grinning.
Naturally, I rushed over as soon as I could. You probably don't remember this, but right after law school, I did a 2-year stint at a human rights nonprofit, defending alleged terrorists' right to trial and such. The pay was shit, and frankly, many of the clients terrified me, so I switched to corporate law. The old skills and lingo are still there, so if you ever get accused of aiding and abetting a suspected terrorist and need a lawyer on an hour's notice, I'm your man.
Peter is an assassin, not a terrorist, but I don't bother arguing that point. You're right, I say, smiling. I remember that now. Your parents worried about you the entire time you worked at that place.
Yep.
His grin widens for a second. Then his expression turns serious, and he says quietly,
I'm sorry about your mom. She's an amazing lady, and I hope she pulls through.
Thanks. Me too. My throat tightens, and I have to blink again. Joe considerately lets me look out the window at the night-dark streets until I regain control. Then he says gently,
Sarah, obviously I'm not really your lawyer. Your father will find someone much more qualified to handle your case. But I want you to know that you can still talk to me if you want. I don't know what happened to you, and it's totally fine if you don't want to discuss it. But I just want you to know that I'm here for you, okay?
I look at him, at the earnestness of his blue eyes, and for the first time, I wish I'd made a different choice back in college. That instead of jumping into a committed relationship with George when I was barely 18, I'd taken things slower and paid more attention to the son of my parents' friends. The nice, quiet one who'd always been on the periphery of my life. It's true, he had never excited me, but maybe attraction would have grown with time. If I'd given it a chance. I grew up hearing stories about Joe, about his successes in school, and how proud his parents were of him, but I never paid much attention. He's 7 years older, and that age difference seemed insurmountable when I was a teen. By the time I was in my 20s, it was nothing. But by then, I was married. We never had a chance to explore what might have been, and we're certainly not going to get that chance now. Not with a Russian assassin dominating my life and my heart. Thank you, Joe. I appreciate it. I keep my tone light, pretending like the offer meant nothing. Like he didn't just indicate a willingness to involve himself in the terrifying mess that is my life. I don't know what my parents have told the Levinsons about my situation, but between the suspected terrorist comment and having to get me from the FBI building downtown, Joe must have some idea of what he'd be facing. He understands my dismissal for what it is and falls silent. For the rest of the ride to the hospital, we don't speak, and it's just as well. There is no room in my life for Joe, and it's not safe for him to think otherwise.
Chapter 12. Peter. We don't return to Japan. With Sarah in the FBI's clutches, it's too risky. Instead, we fly to Prague, where our safe house is in a small village some 20 kilometers from the city. It snowed overnight, and the place looks remarkably picturesque, with a pristine white layer covering all the roofs and bare tree branches. Why couldn't we have gone someplace warm? Anton grumbles as he exits the car into a pile of snow. Seriously, that safe house in India sounds fucking good right about now. If I hadn't just let go of the woman who is my life, I'd have laughed at the disgusted look on his face. But I'm not in the mood for Anton's bullshit, so I just say tersely, because Eastern Europe is where we need to be. Not that I need to say it, he knows as well as I do why we're here. During the flight, I rescheduled the meeting with Novak, moving it up to next week. Henderson is still AWOL, and if I can't spend time with Sarah, there's no point in putting the meeting off. I like it here, Ilya says, looking around the snowy landscape. We don't have as much privacy here as we did in Japan, but the house is sufficiently far from the neighbors to give us at least the illusion of having a private winter retreat. It's pretty. I'm with Anton on this one. I'm sick and tired of the cold, Jan says, heading toward the house. At least we'll be warm soon. I hear Esquerra's compound in the jungle is nice and toasty. He glances at me as he says this, but I don't rise to the bait. At this point, no one needs to know what I'm really planning. It's safer for everyone that way. It's not until we're unpacked and settled into the new house that I allow myself to think of Sarah and feel the agonizing emptiness that is her absence in my life. It's only been a day, but I already ache for her, want her so much it tears me up inside. The Americans are keeping tabs on her, so I'll be getting daily reports, but it's not enough. I want her here, at my side. I want to hold her, to see her smile and hear her laugh, to fuck her until she's too hoarse to scream my name and the raw burn in my veins subsides. Soon, I promise myself, as I head out to explore the area and set perimeter alarms. I will have my Petichka again soon. For now, she can enjoy her former life.
Chapter 13. Sarah. Mom! I bend over her bed, smiling through the tears. Her eyes are cloudy with painkillers, but they're open, and as I gently fold my fingers around her uninjured right hand, her cracked lips move. Sarah. It's me, Mom. The tears pour down my face unchecked, and I don't bother wiping them away. I'm too relieved, too overjoyed. After an entire night of touch and go, Mom has woken up. Here, drink. I lift a cup with a straw to her lips, and she manages one sip before closing her eyes again. I squeeze her hand and turn to Dad, who got to his feet behind me. His cheeks are wet as he stares at his wife.
She's going to be okay now, right?
His eyes are red-rimmed but hopeful as he glances at me, and I nod, not hiding my elation. Her vitals are stable and have been for the past 3 hours,
Barring an infection, she'll pull through. Mom's fingers twitch in my hand, and I look back to find her eyes open again. Sarah, are you really? She blinks and tries to focus through the lingering haze of anesthesia. Darling, is that really you, or am I dreaming? I'm really here, Mom. My voice cracks. I'm home. She came back, Lorna. Dad wraps an arm around my waist, his smile both tremulous and triumphant. Our little Sarah came back. What? She starts to cough, and I quickly give her another sip of water. What happened? Her confused gaze wanders from me to the pulleys holding up the casts on her leg and her left arm, and then back to me again. Dad sinks into a chair next to the bed as I wipe the tears off my face and say as steadily as I can, You were T-boned by a drunk driver on your way to the grocery store. You have cracked ribs, your legs are broken in several places, and your left arm is basically crushed. You also had internal injuries, which necessitated 3 surgeries back to back. I could have sugarcoated it, but Mom hates being babied when it comes to important medical stuff. She always wants to know the full extent of the problem in as much detail as possible. I'll never forget how she hounded Dad's doctors when he had his heart attack a few years back. By the time Dad left the hospital, she knew more about his condition and treatment options than most cardiologists. Her dry lips move again. No, I meant... She struggles to form the words. You're here. How did you... Peter brought me home, Mom, I say softly, squeezing her hand again. As soon as we heard about the accident, he brought me home. It's a dangerous game I'm playing, maintaining the lie, which is now the truth, of being Peter's lover for my parents, while denying it to the FBI. But I don't see any other way to handle it. Peter will be back for me, and I can't have my parents thinking he's a monster when he takes me away again. As risky as it is, they need to believe we're in love. And at the same time, the FBI need to believe I'm Peter's victim. I have no idea how I'm going to manage this tightrope act, but I'm going to try my best. Not that Dad actually believes me. While we were waiting for Mom to wake up, he put me through an interrogation that made the FBI's pale in comparison. His goal was to poke holes in the fairy tale I've been telling them all these months, and despite my best efforts, he wasn't entirely unsuccessful. No, I didn't know Peter was a wanted man when we met and started dating, I told Dad, repeating what I said before about believing my new boyfriend was a contractor working for various firms in the U.S. and abroad. No, I didn't know he was in trouble with the law when I left the country with him, though I was beginning to have some suspicions. No, he's not as dangerous as they say. It's all a big misunderstanding. He does, in fact, work as an independent contractor doing security consulting. It's just that some clients of his are not entirely law-abiding, and that's what got him in trouble with the FBI. Yes, we first met in a nightclub in Chicago, and dated in secret for several weeks. Yes, he bought my house through a shell corporation, like the FBI said. Why? Because he thought I'd regret selling it so impulsively. Some questions were more difficult to answer. I know what the FBI have told my parents about Peter's alleged crimes. Next to nothing, invoking the classified status of his case. However, my parents aren't stupid, and they did some investigating on their own. The suspected terrorist and killed people bits come from a conversation Dad overheard between the agents, but he also somehow linked my abduction to a high-speed chase on I-294, during which a police helicopter blew up, causing a massive pileup and a renewed outcry about gang-related violence in Chicago. It happened the night you disappeared, and was all over the news for weeks, Dad told me. The FBI wouldn't admit it to us, but I know it was him. It had to be. Why else would they send an entire SWAT unit to retrieve you? The man is dangerous, and the feds know it. I don't know if he's involved in drugs, terrorism, or what have you, but he's bad news. And no matter how much I tried to convince Dad that Peter's alleged crimes are white-collar in nature, and that I don't know anything about that interstate incident, which I don't, because I was drugged during my abduction, he refused to believe me. Tell me about Marcia and the Levinsons, I finally said,
desperate to change the topic. How did they come to be here with you? Thankfully, that worked, and for the next couple of hours, we talked about my parents' life in my absence, and how the Levinsons really stepped up, helping my parents through the crisis in a variety of ways. And Marcia, too. Apparently, she'd taken to calling my parents every week, checking on them and inquiring about me. As soon as she heard that Lorna was brought into the ER, she showed up, getting the best doctors on her case and helping us cut through the red tape, Dad said, his eyes gleaming with tears. If it weren't for her, I don't know if your mom would have... He broke off, dragging in a shuddering breath, and I hugged him, feeling the familiar burn of guilt and shame, of self-disgust mixed with rekindled anger at Peter. Yes, my tormentor brought me back, but first he stole me. For months, he kept me from my family. I can't forget that. I should have been there for my parents, not Marcia and their friends. I should have been the one to make sure Mom got the best care. Instead, I was in Japan, falling for my husband's murderer, letting him burrow into my heart and mind as I lied to my parents, over and over again. I want to hate Peter for that, for everything, really. But instead, I just hate myself. I hate that I already miss him, that being home hasn't lessened my desperate longing one bit. I crave him so intensely it's like a physical ache. My skin literally hurts when I think of how badly I want his touch. Soon, I tell myself, as I bend down to kiss Mom, who closed her eyes again. I know Peter. He won't stay away from me for long. I should enjoy this time with my family, instead of pining for the man who'll take me from them. I'm a terrible daughter, but they don't need to know that yet. They'll find out soon enough. Chapter 14. Sarah. By noon, I finally convince Dad to go home and get some rest, and I stay at the hospital with Mom, alternating between keeping her company and napping on a cot the nurses brought to her room. Whenever I come out to grab a coffee or a bite to eat, several suspicious-looking men follow me. FBI agents, most likely, though they could also be plainclothes police. I have no idea how their jurisdictions work. I'm obviously not off the hook, but for now, they're letting me get on with my life, and I'm grateful for that. I don't want to spend what little time I have here in jail. Marcia comes by Mom's room after getting off her shift, and after verifying that Mom is sleeping deeply, I let Marcia talk me into going to Patty's to catch up. So, she says, as we take a back seat at the corner table. You're back. I'm back, I confirm, then wave for the waiter to come over. I'm running on almost no sleep, and I'm craving something really greasy and unhealthy. In general, I feel like I'm falling apart, my whole body aching with exhaustion, and my lower back killing me from spending the night curled up on the hospital cot. Burger and fries, with extra cheese and pickles, I tell the waiter when he comes over. And make it fast, please. I'm starving. Marcia raises her eyebrows, but doesn't comment on my upcoming grease fest. Instead, she orders a Greek salad and two beers, one for each of us. So we can celebrate the prodigal daughter's return, she says, and I attempt to match her grin as guilt floods my chest again. Thank you for keeping an eye on my parents while I was away, I say when the waiter leaves. Dad told me how helpful you were with Mom, and I'm hugely grateful. If there's ever anything I can do for you. She waves away my thanks with a perfectly manicured hand. Oh, please, it was my pleasure. I like your folks, and I'm really sorry that happened to your mom. I hope she recovers soon. Me too. I attempt another smile. So, tell me, how have you been? And Andy and Tanya? Is Andy still with... Oh, no you don't. Marcia folds her forearms on the table and leans forward, skewering me with her gaze. I'm not going to talk about any of that until you tell me where the hell you've been, who this man that you ran off with is, and why the fuck I didn't hear a peep about him until you disappeared off the face of the earth. I didn't disappear. I called my parents all the time, and... She cuts me off with another wave. Semantics. You were gone. Not a word to anyone beforehand. No notice to your practice. Left all your patients hanging. Including that one girl, who needed a C-section the next day, mind you. Oh, and the FBI hounded us all about you for weeks. If that's not a disappearance, I don't... Okay, okay, fine. You win. I grab my beer from the waiter as he approaches the table, but I don't drink it beyond wetting my lips. Not only am I jet-lagged and sleep-deprived, but there was a chance I might be pregnant. Putting down the glass, I stare at the brown liquid, forcing all thoughts of a potential pregnancy away so I can focus. I don't know which version of the story to give Marcia. The one for the FBI, in which I'm Peter's victim all the way, or the one I've been feeding my parents, in which I'm in love with a man who's embroiled in something shady, but is, for the most part, wrongly persecuted by the authorities. You're stalling, Marcia says, and I sigh, looking up from the beer. You're right. I did disappear, I begin slowly, still trying to decide what the best story for Marcia would be. You talked to my parents, though, right? They must have told you what happened. What they knew, which wasn't much. Marcia picks up her beer. Nor did it make any sense, what with the FBI sniffing around us like bomb-detecting dogs. Uh-huh. I instinctively glance around and see two of the men who've been following me around the hospital at a table on the opposite side of the bar. Three tables over are two more of my stalkers, and I'm pretty sure I've seen the guy at the bar before as well. Well, that decides it. The bomb-detecting dogs are out in full force, and I have no doubt Marcia will be questioned shortly after our conversation. In fact, there's no guarantee she's not working with them right now. As soon as the thought occurs to me, I feel like a horrible friend. But that doesn't make the suspicion go away. It makes too much sense. We've known each other for a number of years. I met Marcia when I started my residency at the hospital. But we've always been more work friends than anything else. For one thing, Marcia's always been single and on the hunt, whereas I was married and working 80-hour weeks. I could never accompany her on the girls' night outings she loves, and she found sedate activities like family dinners boring. So our friendship tended to revolve around the hospital, and our conversations rarely ventured beyond the superficial. She was kind and supportive after George's accident, always ready to lend a sympathetic ear on a coffee break, but she never went out of her way to involve herself in the messier aspects of my life. Marcia is a good friend, a fun friend, but not the kind of friend who'd take to calling my parents every week. Not without a nudge, at least. A nudge that could have easily come from the FBI. Of course, it's just as possible that I'm way too tired to think straight. Either that, or being with Peter has made me far too paranoid. Still, on the off chance that my suspicions are right, or on the far more reasonable assumption that I can't expect Marcia to lie to the FBI for me, I decide to go with the victim version of the story. Unfortunately, that means I have to go back to the beginning and explain about George. And since I'm pretty sure that the FBI would not want me to reveal any classified information, I need to get creative here as well. My head hurts, just thinking of all the half-truths and lies I'll have to keep straight. By the time I'm done spinning the beginning of the tale, Marcia's eyes are wider than the burger I'm devouring. George was on this Russian assassin's hit list. Why? What did he... I never learned all the details, but it had something to do with a mafia story George ran. I decide to use the FBI's original lie to me as justification for Peter's actions. In any case, he broke into my house, waterboarded and drugged me to find out George's location. And then he killed him. I let Marcia digest that while I stuff two fries into my mouth. I really am starving. When I see that she's about to launch into more questions, I say, "So, yeah, that's how we really met. You see why I couldn't tell this to my parents, right?" She nods, her face sickly pale underneath her foundation, and her salad forgotten in front of her. "Right," I continue. "So it took me a while to start getting over that, and then you invited me for a night out with Andy and Tanya. We went to that club downtown, remember? The one with the cute bartender, who later asked about me?" Marcia nods again, still mute. "That's when he approached me again," I tell her. "Right there at that club. That's why Andy thought I was acting weird when I bailed. I'd just been approached by my husband's murderer and ordered to meet him the next day at Starbucks. And things just went downhill from there. He had cameras installed all over my house. He followed me everywhere I went. And when I tried to escape to a hotel, he showed up in my room and... Well, never mind that. I let Marcia draw her own conclusions, which, judging by the horror on her face, are far worse than what actually happened. I feel awful about that. My instinct is to shield my friend from the dangerous mess in my life, as I've been shielding my parents. But this is what I told the FBI, and I have to stick with it. Besides, it's all true, or at least factual. The only part I'm withholding is my own confusion about all of this, my unwilling attraction to the man I should have only hated and despised. An attraction that has grown into so much more. Oh, God, Sarah! Marcia looks like she's on the verge of throwing up whatever little salad she consumed. I'm so, so sorry, hon. I had no idea. And this monster, he then kidnapped you? After a few weeks, when the FBI discovered he was in the area, yes. Before that, he let me go on with my life, and he was just... in it. I motioned the waiter for water, since I can't drink my beer. I'm thirsty and strangely lightheaded, as though I've already had alcohol. In general, I feel terrible. The ache in my lower back intensifying unbearably, and my stomach roiling from all the greasy food. I'm also uncomfortably hot, and feel like I want to cry. Must be all the stress catching up to me. I don't understand, Marcia says, as I take a deep breath in an effort to clear my head. Why did he do this? Why you? Is this something he does? Kidnapping women? Did he have a whole harem of victims at... Where was it that he took you? Japan. And, no, to the best of my knowledge, I'm the only one he's ever done this to. As to why? Well, why do some men do anything? I manage a wobbly smile. He got obsessed with me, I guess. In any case, eventually he got bored, and here I am. Marcia is staring at the scar on my forehead. Did he do that to you? She touches her own forehead, her voice strained. Did he hurt you? No. That scar is from a car accident, when I tried to escape and crashed instead, I say. In general, he didn't really hurt me. The whole kidnapping and murdering of George aside, he treated me fairly well. Right. That's good, I guess. Marcia's voice shakes as she reaches for her beer. I notice that her hand is unsteady as well, and fresh guilt scours my insides. I wish I could tell her everything, make her understand how complicated Peter is, how he can be cruel and kind at the same time. How being with him was both wonderful and terrifying, like riding on a roller coaster with no brakes. I wish I could tell her the whole messy truth, but I can't. So I pasted a plastic smile on my face and excuse myself to use the restroom. My stomach is churning so hard it's starting to cramp, and I'm sweating, despite the cold draft sweeping into the bar from the open door. As I enter the small, dingy bathroom, the cramping sensation intensifies, and a sudden suspicion occurs to me, making my breath stall in my lungs. Could it be? Is it finally here? Sure enough, when I check, I find a smear of blood on my underwear. My period, now over a week overdue, has finally started. That's why I'm feeling so shitty. It's the first day, and all the symptoms are there, from the lower back pain and the hot flashes to the moodiness and the cramps. It's official. I'm not pregnant. Peter and I are not having a baby. It should have been a relief, but as I stare at that reddish-brown smear, it grows in my vision, coloring my world the same bloody shade. Shaking, I press my fist to my mouth, but I can't contain the sob that rises in my throat, nor the one that follows. As insane as it is, I feel like I lost something, like some perverse part of me had not only reconciled to the possibility of a child, but had also been looking forward to it. This baby, the one I was so sure I didn't want, never existed outside of my fears. Yet I feel its loss as keenly as if I'd miscarried. "Are you okay?" Marcia asks, when I emerge from the bathroom some 20 minutes later, and I nod, not bothering to hide my swollen eyes and blotchy face as I gulp down my now warm beer. I know what she's thinking, that telling the story of my abduction took an emotional toll on me, reminding me of the trauma of what I went through. And I let her think that, because it's better than the truth. It's better than her knowing that despite what Peter has done, despite the awful crimes he's committed, both against me and others, I'm as obsessed with him as he is with me. That as wrong as it is, I now belong to him. Mind, body, and heart.
Chapter 15, Peter. The week leading up to the meeting with Novak is among the longest of my life. We replenish our supplies, procure more weapons, and step up daily training, pushing ourselves to the point of complete exhaustion, but it's not enough to make the hours pass any faster. Each day feels like a month, each night a never-ending struggle to sleep without Sarah by my side. If it weren't for the daily reports from the men I hired to watch her, I'd already be on the plane to the U.S., her parents' need for her and my plan be damned. Not that the reports are all that thorough. The FBI are all over Sarah, following her around everywhere she goes, and my men have to hang back, being careful not to attract attention. Aside from the obvious danger to them, it wouldn't be good for Sarah if the FBI knew I'm still interested in her. Thanks to our hackers getting into Ryson's files, I know what Sarah told them, and I don't want to undermine any aspect of her story. The agents have to believe I got bored with her and let her go for good. Otherwise, they'll hide her away and likely charge her with aiding and abetting. The only reason they haven't already done the latter is Sarah's family's connections. Between her dead husband's media contacts and her parents' lawyer friends with Washington ties, this case has the potential to make national headlines, something a lot of highly placed individuals, Henderson included, are desperate to avoid. For now, Sarah is safe, but she won't be if she gets caught lying. In any case, while she was away, the FBI found all the cameras and listening devices I placed in her house, and after she appeared so fortuitously following her mother's accident, it occurred to them to do a thorough sweep of her parents' house as well. So all I have to go on now are the FBI notes our hackers send me, and the generic reports about her movements from the men I hired to follow her. It's not nearly enough, and it eats at me. The need to know what she's doing, how she's feeling, what she's thinking. If I was obsessed with her before, now that I've had her with me all these months, it's more like a physical addiction. "Just fucking go get her already," Anton mutters, wiping the blood off his lip after I punch him far too savagely for a training session. "Or at least take a chill pill. Seriously, man, can't you go a few days without getting your fucking rocks off?" For that, I land a hit directly to his solar plexus, and when he's bent over, gasping like a landed fish, I grab a weighted pack and go for a run to avoid killing him on the spot. I know my friend is right. My temper's been at the boiling point, and I've been taking it out on the guys. But that doesn't lessen my rage and frustration. I haven't slept the full night since, well, since Sarah's accident, come to think of it. The nightmares about my family's deaths, the ones that had all but disappeared thanks to Sarah, are back, only now they're accompanied by an even more terrifying dream in which I lose her. It's my nightly reality. And every time I wake up, covered with cold sweat, I reach for the most recent report on her, reading it over and over again to reassure myself that it was just a dream, that my Petichka is alive and well without me. That given what I'm about to do, she's far safer at home than she would be by my side. It's this last thought that enables me to keep going, to resist the urge to do exactly what Anton said and steal her from under the feds' noses again. I can do it. Their agents are no match for me and my team, But Sarah's mother is still far from well, and Sarah would hate me if I took her away from her family so soon. Besides, I have an entirely different goal in mind, and to achieve it, I have to stay on this path no matter how difficult it might be. I have to believe that ultimately, it will all be worth it.
Chapter 16. Sarah. 1 week without Peter. It feels unreal, like a dream from which I'm waiting to wake up. Or maybe it's the fact that I don't sleep properly that gives my days this strange, dreamlike quality. In some ways, it's like I entered a time machine. I'm in a hospital, waiting for a loved one to recover from a debilitating car accident. Only that time, it was George who was the patient, and he never made it out of his coma. Mom's prognosis is much better. The doctors did a good job patching her up, and her wounds didn't get infected. She's still immobilized with all the casts, and she may never regain full use of her left arm. Too many nerves and tendons were damaged there. But once her broken legs heal, with sufficient physical therapy, she should be able to walk again. Dad is over the moon, both about Mom's prognosis and the fact that I'm home. Every time he enters her room and finds me sitting by her bedside, his mouth quivers like he's about to cry. But instead, he breaks out in a joyous smile. "I keep thinking you're going to disappear," he confesses, when we sit down to eat dinner in the hospital cafeteria. "That if I turn away for a second, it'll go poof." He uncurls his hands in a magician-like move. There one moment, gone the next. "Oh, Dad." I grimace and look down, poking my pasta with a plastic fork. The guilt is eating me alive. Because that's precisely what's going to happen in the near future. As soon as Peter deems my mom well enough. With effort, I manage to look up and smile at my dad. "Please, don't worry. Everything is fine, okay? I'm here, and all is well." I know I sound evasive. Dad has been accusing me of that all week. But it's hard to be convincing while juggling all the lies, half-truths, and facts I've been feeding to different people. The story from my parents and their friends is that Peter is my lover, and that he brought me home despite his ongoing misunderstanding with the FBI, because he loves me and wants me to be there for Mom. The implication here is that one day, Peter's legal troubles will be over, and at that point, we'll have a shot at happiness together. In contrast, the picture I'm painting for the FBI and everyone else is that of a monster who kidnapped me on a whim and eventually got bored enough to let me go. The only reason I'm able to make the dual stories work is that the feds don't want my parents, or anyone really, to know about George's role in all of this. And that goes double for the events that set Peter on his path of vengeance. After I spoke to Marcia that day at the bar, Ryson brought me to their downtown office again, and not so subtly ordered me to keep my mouth shut, confirming my suspicion about Marcia's involvement with the FBI. It was too noisy at the bar for the agents to overhear our conversation, so the only way he could have known exactly what I told her is if she'd reported it to him right away, or maybe even wore a wire. Naturally, I acted contrite and promised to be more discreet. And in return, I extracted a promise that the feds will keep their mouths shut around my parents, doing nothing to dispel the less worrisome paradigm I created for them. As you know, my dad's heart is weak, and he doesn't need the stress of knowing I was forced to lie to them all these months, I told Ryson, and the agent was only too happy to agree. I'm guessing he extracted a vow of silence from Marcia, too, because when I ran into Andy in the hallway, she didn't know anything more than what she must have heard earlier. "What happened?" she asks, eyeing me with unabashed curiosity and confusion. "You just disappeared one day, and the FBI were all over the place, questioning everyone. People were saying you hooked up with some criminal?" "It's a long story," I said, giving her an uncomfortable smile. "Maybe we can get together one of these days and catch up. For now, my mom is waiting." "Oh, of course." She attempted to rein in her obvious disappointment. "Marcia told me what happened with your mom. I'm so sorry. I hope she recovers soon." "She will, thanks. I'll see you around." I waved at her and continued down the hall, trying not to think about how out of place I feel here, at this hospital that was once my second home. How lost and alone I feel without Peter. Soon, I tell myself. He'll come for me soon. All I have to do is wait. And pushing away the guilt that comes with the thought, I put on a bright smile and enter Mom's room.
Chapter 17, Peter. We meet Danilo Novak at a cafe in Belgrade, a modern, stylish-looking place that has been entirely taken over by the Serbian arms dealers' men. Other than the two young baristas behind the glossy white counter, every person in the cafe is armed to the teeth. And for all I know, the pretty teenage baristas are too. Anton is providing backup, a precaution in case things go to shit, but the twins are with me. Walking in, we stop and take in the situation. Novak is sitting at a small round table in the middle of the cafe. It's a location designed to make us uncomfortable. We'll be surrounded on all sides. But I just give the arms dealer a cool smile as we make our way over. Nice place, I say in Russian, going on the assumption that he's more likely to be fluent in my native language than in English. Do you own it? Novak's thin lips curl up. I do. Glad you like it. His Russian is accented, but as fluent as I suspected. Of course, I could speak to him in Serbian. I know most Eastern European languages, as well as Arabic and a few others, but I'd rather not reveal that I understand his native tongue. When dealing with men like Novak, every little advantage counts. He leans back, studying me with a peculiar lack of interest. A tall, thin man in his mid-40s, with a receding hairline and thick glasses. Novak looks like a cross between an accountant and a math professor. Only his eyes betray what he is. Expressionless and pale, they look like they belong to a lizard. Or a stone-cold killer. There's surprisingly little our hackers have been able to learn about the man. He appeared 10 years ago, seemingly out of nowhere, and has since built an illegal weapons empire in Eastern Europe, eliminating rivals with a speed and ruthlessness I've only seen once before, with Julian Esguerra, the man Novak wants us to kill. The only arms dealer left whose criminal enterprise exceeds Novak's own. So, Novak says when I match his detached look with one of my own, you're Sokolov. I nod coolly, not allowing my expression to change, and I know the twins look just as calm. He's not going to disconcert us with these games, and he might as well learn that. Sit, he gestures at the two empty chairs remaining at his table. I don't move, and neither do Jan and Ilya. This is yet another little test, a way to see who's the least important, least valuable on the team. Three of us, two chairs. The math doesn't work, and he knows it. Someone is going to have to stand to be the odd man out, and I'm not going to allow that. He's not going to sow the seeds of discord among us. I won't let him. His unblinking eyes study me for a few long moments, then he motions at one of the thugs at the other table. Victor, another chair for our guests, please. I wait until Victor brings over the chair, and then I sit down. The twins follow my lead. Ilya's face is stony, but Jan looks amused. He understands the importance of these little dominance games, knows the necessity of setting the right tone early on. The teenage baristas come over to take our orders for drinks, but I decline to get anything. Ilya and Jan do the same. We're not thirsty, I say calmly, and Novak's mouth curls again. I have no reason to poison you, he says, and I shrug, dismissing his reassurance like the bullshit it is. There are many substances one can use, from mind-altering drugs to poisons so slow-acting the symptoms don't manifest for weeks or months. He could easily slip something deadly into my drink, and I'd walk out of here not realizing that until after I do the job for him, until my usefulness to him is over. So, Novak says, when he sees that I'm not about to change my mind. Esquera. I cross my arms over my chest and look at him. Finally, we're getting to the point of this meeting. You worked for him, Novak continues as one of the baristas brings his drink, a high-end scotch, judging by the smell and color. I did, I confirm. I expected him to know this, and he does. He's clearly done his due diligence on me. Is that the problem? I don't know. Is it? His pale eyes bore into me. We didn't part on the best of terms. In fact, he's vowed to kill me if I ever cross his path again. But you know that, don't you? I give Novak a cold smile. Isn't that why you reached out to me in the first place? Because I'm in the unique position of having once been in Esquera's inner circle. Novak's gaze remains unblinking. Yes? Is that a mistake on my part? Is your team capable of what I'm asking? That depends. I uncross my arms and lean forward. What are the assets in play that you mentioned? The ones that would help us get this job done? Aside from you and your familiarity with Esquera's compound? Novak's eyes glint as he glances at the twins, who have stayed stoically silent so far. I assume your men can be trusted? I look at him, not bothering to dignify that with a reply. A smile stretches his thin lips again. All right. I might have someone on the inside. You don't need to know who that is yet. Suffice it to say, certain things could be arranged to happen at certain moments, enabling you to carry out your part. Irritation stabs at me. He's not telling me anything I didn't already suspect. Keeping my expression unchanged, I rise to my feet. In that case, you are welcome to find another team, I say, as Jan and Ilya follow my lead. I turn to head to the exit, only to be confronted by a wall of Novak's goons, their weapons drawn and faces feral. Not so fast, Novak says softly. We still have much to discuss. I turn back to face him, ignoring the artillery at my back. We have nothing to discuss, I say evenly. I don't entrust my team's safety to vague assurances of aid from unknown sources. If we aren't to take this job, we need to know everything, down to the smallest logistics. That's how we operate. That's why we're as successful as we are. If you want our services, you tell us everything, or we walk and you get someone else to do this. His bland features tighten. You're making a mistake, Sokolov. I'm not someone you want to fuck with. I bare my teeth in a humorless smile. Neither is Esquera, yet here we are. He stares at me, then jerks his head to one side. Let them pass, he orders, and I turn to see the wall of goons parting. Their weapons lowered, but postures tense. He doesn't want it to get ugly, and I'm glad. Anton's sniper's rifle would have probably taken out a good 3 or 4 of Novak's men, and the 3 of us could have gotten another 7 or 8 easy, but bullets flying is never a good thing. The ultra-thin bulletproof vests we're wearing under our clothes wouldn't protect us from a headshot, and as skilled as we are, we're not immune to lead. You're making a mistake, Novak raises his voice as we head to the exit. Mark my words, Sokolov, you're making a big mistake. I don't respond, and we walk out onto the busy street, blending in with the pedestrians as we head back to our meeting place. He's not going to come through, Anton says as we fill him in on what happened over dinner at a local restaurant. We've wasted our time. Whatever asset he's got at Esquera's compound must be the real deal if he's guarding it so carefully. He's not going to tell us what it is, so we might as well forget it. You saw some of the other offers we got recently, right? They're not bad, either. We do a few of those gigs, and that's our 100 million. We don't need Novak and his secretive shit. I nod, cutting into my steak. I agree. Let's focus on other jobs. Jan raises his eyebrows. Really? Just like that? I meet his gaze. We're not going into this blind, and Novak isn't going to come through, so we're done here. Is that a problem? Because I got the impression you weren't pleased when I wanted to take this job. Jan stares at me, and I stare back at him, my expression calm. I can feel the growing tension between us, but